all across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossum.
And good afternoon. This is Jim Fossone on Veterans Radio. With me is Dale Thronberry. Dale, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and welcome everybody to Veterans Radio.
We're glad to have everybody on board. This is going to be an interesting show, talking about some drone and cyber missions and all those sorts of things that we see and read a little bit about, so we'll have some real experts to talk about it. But as always, at the top of the hour, we're going to talk a little bit about some upcoming things. I did want to mention, Dale, a retirement, actually, of Pat Lafferty. Pat Lafferty has been with the American Legion here in the state of Michigan for 32 years and has been the state adjutant for the American Legion for 17 years and recently retired and received the Distinguished Service Medal from the Michigan Veterans Affairs Association, which is a nice honor for him. And a Vietnam vet who was really committed to helping his fellow veterans and will go off into a well-deserved retirement. So I want to give special recognition to Pat Lafferty.
Well, it's anybody who puts in that amount of time into public service like that and trying to get veterans their benefits and all the other things that he has attempted to do over the last 30 years in Michigan, I congratulate him and wish him well in his next adventure.
Absolutely. We also had something at the national level that you wanted to make sure we brought to people's attention.
Well, there are two stories I wanted to mention to people. The first is the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention for American Veterans Act was passed by Congress, and this is a veteran suicide prevention bill to provide funds to increase the amount of training, not only training, but services and rehab things and programs and training and everything for the VA and for other people out there to help these veterans coming back or that are back now from Afghanistan and Iraq to make that transition back into civilian life. Because for whatever reason, and nobody's been able to come up with a good reason why, the suicide rate among this generation of veterans is higher than any in history. They're averaging around 20 a day. And so this bill is finally passed. It was sponsored by or was written initially by Senator McCain with bipartisan support, as they say. And so now it's passed, and it's on the president's desk, and hopefully he will sign it immediately and start getting this funding and training out there.
Well, that's great. And my recollection of when I read the materials is that it also puts some money into the VA system so that they can hire more therapists and counselors and that sort of thing. And that's really part of the missing component.
Right. Yeah, I don't think that they planned on being overwhelmed quite as much as they have been with the number of men and women coming back. The other story is kind of a ironic, sad, happy, well, it would never be happy, but it's a result of the people that were shot and either killed or wounded in the Fort Hood shooting a number of years ago. And they were arguing back and forth that this was not a war zone, this was not a terrorist attack, and so on and so forth. And they decided that it is considered as war wounds, and so every one of those men and women are going to receive the Purple Heart, which is good for them.
Absolutely, and it's certainly one of the things that those of us who've watched family members spend a lot of time in the military, training is as hazardous as anything else in the military.
And just
being in the service of your country puts you into situations that can be more dangerous than the average citizen realizes it. And I think that's the sort of the Fort Hood situation. But for their service to their country, they wouldn't have been put into that situation.
Absolutely. And so we want to we're very grateful for that, and we want to we appreciate that the Department of Defense has decided to actually follow through on that. So thank you.
That's great. We actually want to now move to one of our folks on the line, if the control room will put Rick Briggs up. We're going to get an update from Major Rick Briggs, retired. Rick's been on Veterans Radio before, talking about one of the many things that he's involved in. This one is Camp Liberty. Rick, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jim. How are you?
Great. We wanted to take this opportunity to bring you back onto the radio and talk a little bit about update us on Camp Liberty and more timely, update us on the Camp Liberty Gala that's coming up.
Well, I'd be happy to do that. First of all, I want to congratulate you guys for highlighting Pat Lafferty and all he's done. I was just at the Veteran Commanders, Service Officer Commanders meeting in Lansing, and they gave him a rousing round of applause. What a wonderful service he gave to his nation, even after service. I'm really happy you did that. Yeah, Camp Liberty is we're an all-volunteer program. We are a 501c3. Nonprofit program to help our combat injured troops and others within individuals with disabilities. But our primary focus is with our injured and disabled veterans. Camp Liberty is a 137-acre facility out in Brooklyn along the River Raisin and about 12 miles northeast of the MIS Speedway for a reference for everybody. We're tied in with the Michigan Operation Freedom Outdoors. They liked what we were doing so much that the State of Michigan created a program to help individuals with disability garner greater access to the outdoors. And we are tied in now, thanks in large part to them, physically and otherwise. They have 4,500 acres that they're putting wildlife habitat in. They've employed two full-time combat injured vets, training them in wildlife habitat and conservation programs. And hopefully that'll lead to a nice career within the Department of Natural Resources for those two young men. We got the Camp Liberty Gala coming up, which you mentioned. That's February 21st over Schoolcraft College. We sold out over a month ahead of the event. And so that's wonderful news. It's a James Bond black tie theme. It's an opportunity to get everybody together and say thank you. We got a room full of sponsors and donors that are coming together. We've raised over $140,000 in in-kind donations towards our program center, which will allow us to conduct a lot of support groups and recreation activities for these troops, and as we try to help them on the reintegration process. And it's wonderful that we have such a powerful and unique board of directors together.
Rick, what type of activities will Camp Liberty have available for the veterans who want to use that property come this spring and this summer?
Well, we're going to be starting off here pretty quick. They're going to be doing some coyote hunts. There's a world people run here in the Lower Peninsula with coyotes. I don't know if you've seen them like I have. I've noticed quite a few of them. But we got coyote hunts, which are helping with the predator control, and then we're going into turkey spring hunts. And then in the summer months, we'll have, you know, a lot of the recreation canoe kayak. We had a $50,000 handicap accessible canoe and kayak launch donated, Easy Dock system. So we'll be putting that in sometime, hopefully this summer. We're building our program center. Hopefully we can get that done before deer season. We'll be doing some pheasant hunts as we turn towards fall, and then that'll lead into fall turkey, and then, you know, squirrel and rabbit and deer archery, and then we have our independence hunt and the liberty hunt that the State of Michigan puts on for our injured and disabled folks.
Well,
and then we'll head into our deer season.
Well, there's certainly plenty of activities planned. If people want to learn more about Camp Liberty, and the tickets for the gala are sold out, but I assume you're still taking donations and sponsors, how do they? Where do they go, and how do they help out?
The easiest way for folks on the Internet is to go to camp-liberty.org. That's camp, C-A-M-P-Liberty, L-I-B-E-R-T-Y.org. And they can get all my contact email and all that. And, yeah, we do need some auction items. If they have something for a silent auction or a live auction to help us raise funds. We're about 130,000 short of completing our entire program center. But we've got a lot of things really coming together on that.
Well, that's great. We really appreciate the update. And as you continue to progress there, we'll continue to get updates from you about Camp Liberty, because it's really going to be a very unique in Michigan location with set of services for our returning veterans. So we're really glad to be able to help it out and promote it a little bit. Rick, thanks for participating, and we'll get a quick message from one of our sponsors, and we'll move on to our next topic, which is with Colonel Ron Ronald W. Wilson of the 110th Attack Wing. So right after these messages.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're pleased to bring on the air with to you for, I think, the first time, Colonel Ron Wilson from the 110th Attack Wing in Battle Creek, Michigan. Ron has a long and distinguished career with the Michigan Air National Guard. Let me just go over a little bit of his career bio for you. We won't give him too much grief about this, but Colonel Wilson is a 1982 graduate of the University of Wisconsin. What do you think about that?
I saw you
had your eyebrows raised. So,
It's still within the same conference. So that's
there you go. He's still Big Ten. So he received his commission from the ROTC program, and he served 8 years active duty and more than now 22 years in the Air National Guard. He's been at Battle Creek for almost all of that time and has had a variety of assignments throughout the country, from pilot training to being the aircraft commander at all sorts of different assignments throughout the country. So, Colonel Wilson, I think you're on board with us, and we want to welcome you to the Veteran Radio audience.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. Sorry we had a little technical trouble getting through, but we're on now, so I'm happy to be on the show with you.
Well, we're grateful for you to take a little time on Sunday to talk to our audience. We have folks not only listening to us on WAAM 1600 Talk Radio, but on veteransradio.net. Our internet application lets people all around the country listen to you. We have folks out in Guam, I think, who...
We have people all over the world, actually. We have some devoted and dedicated listeners down in Australia, so they're very interested in what's going on all the time.
So we're happy to have you, Colonel. Let's start with a little bit of how did you get involved, interested in your military career, and what sort of set you off into this direction?
Sure, you bet. I grew up in Wisconsin, and I always wanted to fly since as old as I can remember, probably 4 or 5 years old. Upon graduating high school, I graduated from Elkhart Lake High School in Wisconsin. I then went up to Superior, Wisconsin, and entered the University of Wisconsin, the Superior Extension up there, and they have an ROTC program, an Air Force ROTC program. So I joined that. And competed very well and ended up getting a pilot training slot out of college and was commissioned a Air Force officer. I then proceeded down to Lubbock, Texas, Reese Air Force Base, and I did my year of undergraduate pilot training down at Reese Air Force Base, again competing for top spots, and I did well at that. So I got my first selection out of there, which was the A-10 Warthog. And went off to fighter leading school in Alamogordo, New Mexico at Holloman Air Force Base, and then on to Tucson, Arizona, Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, which was where you learned how to fly the A-10. Upon graduation there, I headed off for England Air Force Base in Louisiana, Alexandria, Louisiana, and I flew active duty there for 3.5 years flying the A-10. And then once I was done with that, my next assignment was back to Holloman Air Force Base as a fighter lead-in instructor. Upon completion of that assignment, I then decided to get out of the Air Force, and I got on with American Airlines flying for them and have flown for them ever since. But I'd missed the military, so I looked into the Air National Guard and looked at a bunch of bases, and Battle Creek, Michigan was getting A-10, so that's where I ended up. And I got to fly A-10s here at Battle Creek for 17 years. And then we lost the A-10 through the BRAC, which is the Base Realignment and Closure. in 2005, and the airplanes actually left in 2008. And then we went through about 6 years of what mission are we going to fly. We flew C-21s for a little while, for about 4 years. That was a Learjet that took VIPs and DVs around the country, military. And for a while we were going to fly something called a C-27. It's a C-130 light cargo aircraft. That got canceled by the president. So at that point, we were awarded the MQ-9 RPA, which RPA stands for Remotely Piloted Aircraft. And we are in the process right now of standing that up. And as I worked my way through the Battle Creek ranks, I ended up as a squadron commander back in the A-10 days. And then I ended up as an ops group commander, which is command of the operations side of the house, and closed out the A-10 flying, and did that flying C-21s and started into the RPA. And then I became the vice wing commander and eventually the wing commander. I've been the wing commander now for almost 3 years. And like I said, we are in the midst of standing up the RPA mission. We have currently 15 pilots trained, 13 sensor operators, and right now, because we do not have a building yet, we're working on that. Our pilots are flying all over the country at other units. So that kind of brings me up to speed on where we are today.
So let me back you up, and if we have a little time at the end, we may back up to talk about the A-10s. We've had your predecessor, retired Colonel Roger Seidel, on to talk about DOD's plan on the A-10s, and
sure.
It's been in the news a little bit, so if we have time, I'll get to that. But we're really bumped into you, month or more ago at the Battle Creek base, and you were mentioning the remotely piloted aircraft or RPA mission, and I said, boy, we've got to talk about that. So that kind of is the focus of today's program, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about what does not in military speak, but in plain English, what does remotely piloted aircraft mean? What's the RPA program?
Sure. It is, I think a lot of the public, hears the word drone, and to the military, that's kind of a bad word, I guess, because it's got such a bad connotation in the press. But we like to call it the remotely piloted aircraft, and that is what Battle Creek has or is getting is something called remote split ops. And if you think about it in layman's terms, what that means is the cockpit of the airplane is sitting here at Battle Creek. And controlled by Battle Creek airmen. The aircraft themselves are actually flying overseas, and in the Middle East and in Afghanistan and all the places that are needed. The aircraft is about the size of an A-10. What that means to people, I guess, the wingspan is about 66 feet wide. So it is a fairly good-sized aircraft. The aircraft does ISR. So what it has is what they call a sensor ball on it.
And ISR stands for?
Stands for Intelligence, Survey, and Reconnaissance. That's one of its missions. Another mission is it is a strike aircraft, so it does drop bombs from the aircraft. And the aircraft, the good thing about the RPA is it can stay airborne for a very long time. We're talking 12, 14, 16 hours. So it's airborne for a long time, so it can do that surveillance stuff on enemy positions overseas. So it's controlled by us at Battle Creek. We have a separate unit, if you will, over wherever the aircraft is based overseas, and they are called a launch and recovery element, and they are responsible for getting the aircraft airborne. And then they fly it to a couple thousand feet, and then Battle Creek, or whatever unit happens to be flying it, takes over control via satellite link and a cable underneath the ocean, and we take control of the aircraft. And then we have three people who run it. One is a pilot, and he does what you would think for a normal pilot. One is a sensor operator, and the sensor operator operates the optical ball inside, which is your cameras that look at your targets. And then we have somebody called a MIC, and that's your intelligence guy. And he's gathering intelligence from all kinds of sources to find out what's going on the ground, what kind of threats there are to the aircraft, what kind of threats are to other aircraft that we have flying in the area that may be manned aircraft. So that's kind of it in a nutshell what the RPA does. It basically does everything we did in the A-10, except the pilot is just not sitting in the aircraft. He is sitting back here on the ground performing the same kind of functions.
So, Colonel, let's talk a little bit about the training that you've mentioned. And let's focus on the unit that's with the the 110 airlift wing. You mentioned you have 15 pilots and 13 sensor operators. Let's talk a little bit about the training that the pilots go through first. How does that differ from what we might be thinking of pilot training, and give us some of that insight?
Yeah, this is all new technology stuff. So as we're spinning up into this thing, the guys that we had here before, the A-10 guys, some other kinds of backgrounds, went through your basic pilot training 1 year. Of pilot training, they went off and flew some kind of aircraft, be it A-10s, F-16s. We have some that flew tankers or cargo-type aircraft. And then we hire them here at Battle Creek, and they're fully qualified pilots. And then we send them off to RPA school, if you will. And ours, the one that we go to mostly, is in Syracuse, New York. And that is another guard unit that has something called the it's called an FTU, and it stands basically for the training unit. They train all the pilots. And they go through about 5 months of getting used to flying an RPA. A little bit different because it's a little bit more computer-based. The other thing is when you're flying overseas, when you turn, say you're going to make a right turn, when you put the input in, nothing happens for about 2 seconds, and then the aircraft will start to turn. So that's something the pilots have to get used to. It's a little bit abnormal from what they're used to. And they go through 5 months of that. And when they come out of that, they have basic qualification. So they can fly the airplane, they can climb the altitude, they can turn, and they can operate all the systems. Then they have to go through something called mission-ready training. And that's another month and a half, depending on how well the guy's doing. And then he'll come up to speed on actually employing the airplane. What I mean is working with ground personnel on the radio, working with AWACS aircraft, dropping bombs, finding targets. Now once those guys are mission ready, now they can sit in that seat and they can go into what we call a combat sortie.
So Colonel, in regular aircraft you're getting rated for different types of airframes. Is it the same thing with UAVs, or do you get rated for a certain type of, to use the civilian term, drone or unmanned vehicle, or do they all sort of, once you're rated across the board?
No, you're right. It's very similar. The two kinds of variants that they have out, that for the most part, there's a few others, but the two main RPA or UAV aircraft that are out in the Air Force right now. One is the MQ-1 Predator, and the other one is the MQ-9 Reaper. And all our guys are getting trained on the MQ-9 Reaper. It is a different aircraft. The MQ-9 Reaper is more of a bomb-dropping aircraft, and it's bigger. And the MQ-1 Predator is more of just that ISR. They look, you know, with cameras and take pictures and try to find out intelligence. And they're different aircraft. They have different characteristics. The MQ-1 Predator is a lot smaller, and the MQ-9 Reaper is a lot bigger aircraft. It flies a lot faster. So they are different, and you're correct. You need to get rated in each one. We are standing up the MQ-9 mission. There are other guard units around the country that have been in the MQ-1, and now they are converting, and they'll all at some point will all be MQ-9 because that's the newer technology. It can do more capabilities. You know, that airplane can do not only ISR, but it also can employ weapons. So that's what the Air Force is looking for.
With just a few minutes left before we hit our news break, with respect to the pilots, at 15 pilots, is that anticipated to be Battle Creek's full complement? And how many, if you're up in the air running for 12 or 16 hour shifts, how many RPA missions can you run with 15 pilots?
Yeah, the 15 is what we are up to so far, but we're still in the process of standing the mission up. When we're all done, we are supposed to go what they call IOC, initial operating experience, happens in August of 2016. And that means we'll have our building all built, the cockpits will be here at Battle Creek, and we'll have our full complement of pilots trained by then, and that is a little bit north of 50 pilots. And that also is 50 sensor operators and 50 of the intel guys. On a 16, 18-hour mission, each pilot will fly about 4 hours. And it varies a little bit when they're trying to find out what the best mix is. But it'll be 4 hours, and it might be 4 hours where you're just sitting up there looking at something. When we're flying overseas, and any time collateral damage is a possibility.
We're going to come to our news break here, Colonel. Thanks for hang on after the news. We're going to talk about what the sensor operators, how they get trained up, and those issues. So we'll be back right after the news.
Conway Truckload honors the service of American military men and women with an apprenticeship program that allows veterans to use the GI Bill to supplement their income during their first year driving, as well as tuition reimbursement when they begin. Conway Truckload wants to continue the tradition of service right here at home. To learn more, call 866-WORK-FOR-US or visit online true2blue.com/military.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're talking to Colonel Ron Wilson, commander of the 110th Airlift Wing at the Kellogg Air National Guard Base in Battle Creek, Michigan, about RPA, their RPA mission, remotely piloted aircraft. And we were just finishing up with the discussion on the training of the pilots. And, Dale, you had a question for the colonel.
I did. Thank you, Colonel. This is Dale Thronberry. I was wondering if the pilots are flying in cockpits, are they like trainers or simulators, or how is the setup of the crew when they're working a mission?
You bet. It's called a ground control station, and it is like a cockpit on the ground, basically. We will have, at Battle Creek, we'll have two permanent ones, and then there's also one is a mobile control station, which is basically on a like a semi-trailer.
Mm-hmm.
But the pilot is in there. And the sensor operator is next to the pilot operating that sensor ball. And then the intel guy is kind of in the background. He's working phones and a computer, like a computer chat line with all kinds of agencies. So he's a little bit more in the background, but the cockpit is the two people, the sensor and the pilot.
It sounds fascinating. I was just reading an article during the break from, it says, Army General Martin Dempsey, that says he will never use the word drone, and you will never hear him use the word unmanned aerial systems, because they're not. They are remotely piloted aircraft, and I guess that's a term that we all have to get used to.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the drone kind of, one, it's got the bad connotation, and two, it means something that's not piloted by anybody. These are highly sophisticated aircraft. And it takes about 140 people on the ground to have these operations go correctly. So it there's a lot to it.
That's what I was going to say. If you're going to have 50 pilots and 50 of these, you're going to have 500 or so. It's going to become a large contingent out there.
It is. And it, like I said, it takes a lot. And the other thing you got to remember is this is a 24/7 mission. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do this 24/7, 365 days a year. So at all times you'll have pilots flying them from Battle Creek once we stand up here at Battle Creek.
And, Colonel, can you talk a little bit about the rank of the pilots, the officers who are going to be flying here, are they? Does this integrate right into the normal rank system for those who are, would otherwise be pilots?
It does. In any squadron of aircraft or anything, you want a little bit of variety. So you've got some younger guys, you know, your lieutenants and your young captains, and then the leadership in the squadron is usually majors and colonels, light colonels, and you have some of them too. So we got a normal complement of rank throughout the squadron.
Well, you told us about the training for the pilots. Can you talk to us a little bit about the sensor operators and the training that they all go through for this new world, new technology?
You bet. And I'm not quite as familiar, obviously, because I'm not a sensor operator, but they go through almost the same amount of training the pilots do, just a hair less. And they can be an enlisted person or they could be an officer, but they're not the rated type. But their main mission is to operate that sensor ball, so they need to keep, you know, if it's the video part, they need to keep that on the target. We have an IR part, an infrared part. They need to keep that, find the targets. And it's a very intense tasking to keep that, because you got to remember that same thing the pilot has, if that two-second delay, the sensor operator has that too. So when he tries to move the target tracking cross or the ball around, he has to lead it by 2 seconds.
And is the communication that then to the intel officer, is he the one who's communicating back maybe with ground forces or other aircraft in the area that may take action relative to the target?
Absolutely. He is communicating with everybody. He's communicating with commanders on the ground for their intent, what they want to do. He's communicating with somebody called a JTAC, and that's usually the person that's closest to the target that has eyes on from the ground. He's communicating with the AWACS aircraft that are airborne, that are telling them where all the other aircraft are. So he's communicating with a lot of people, and then the pilot and the sensor also.
Colonel, how difficult has it been to find, not just for the Battle Creek group, but really for the Air Force or the Air National Guard entirely, to find pilots and sensor operators to move into this new field?
Yeah, it's so far for us, it's been pretty good. We've got guys ready to go to training, but as we move into this mission, I think it is going to be a challenge. It's a whole different ball game. You know, when we were in A-10s, we would train here, prepare for war, deploy to war, and then, you know, fight the war and you'd come home. Now a guy is home with his wife and kids and he leaves and goes and flies combat from Battle Creek with an airplane overseas and does combat for 4 to 8 hours, and then he goes back home. And he does it day in and day out. So the amount of flying, the amount of combat action, you know, probably will tend to wear on people. They're going to see a lot of things that aren't pleasant to see sometimes when you talk in combat. And it's, like I said, it's at 24 hours, you know, on Christmas Eve, somebody will be out here flying one of those aircraft. So it's tougher. It's tougher. Yeah, I think it will be a challenge to recruit to, and it's a new paradigm we're trying to kind of figure out as we go.
One of the things that's always been of concern is that the guard mission, because when you're stationed on a base, you go back and you may stay on the base quarters. There's more community input. And so it sounds like that you're thinking about how the stresses are different under this mission on the troops, and how to maybe deal with that or combat that, not only in recruitment but also in retention, and how they integrate back into the community at home with their spouses and family and civilian workforce. Is that part of the conversation now at the leadership level?
Absolutely. It is a big part of the conversation. You know, a guard unit is designed to have lots of part-time guys who come in on the weekend and then spin up for war. Since this is a 24/7 mission, we have more full-time force than we had before, and we still have to have our part-timers in on this too, you know, the ones who come in on that drill weekend. So it's a different mix than it used to be, and absolutely the base community is different. Now our all our support folks, they're not only supporting people, you know, 8 to 5, but they're also supporting people at 2 in the morning. So it's different. Our chaplains and we have a WDPH, a psychological health professional on base, that this takes on a whole new role for them because of the type of mission.
Well, Colonel, we really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about the RPA mission. There, as you know, because you and I have had some dialogue on it, there is an Air Force memo out, internal service memo out, regarding concern that the fleet that's flying these RPAs is sort of at the breaking point. And we're going to talk about that a little bit with our next guest. I don't want to push you out any farther on the limb than appropriate.
No problem.
but I think you've really educated us a lot, and that's been really helpful. As you stand this mission up and get closer to August of 2016, I'm sure Veterans Radio will want to check back in with you.
We want to go there.
Yeah, and see how this is. Dale's an old chopper pilot, so he's having a hard time visualizing all this.
Yeah, I want to go there. I want to see this stuff.
I don't see this. It's a different type of mission.
Well, we really appreciate the time that you've spent with us this afternoon. We'll let you get back to your family, and thank you and the 110th Airlift Wing for all it's doing to protect us here in this country.
You bet. We're glad to serve.
And we'll go to a short sponsor, and we'll be right back with our next guest.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And welcome back. Welcome back to Veterans Radio. Our next guest is Dan Gettinger from the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College. Dan, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, we're glad to have you. I know you were on the line a little earlier. I can see that from the control room. So you got a chance to hear Colonel Wilson talk about the RPA mission that is being stood up locally. And that sort of blends into a little bit about why I wanted to talk with you and talk maybe a little bit about a particular internal memo that I know you wrote on. But before we get there, Dan, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Center for the Study of the Drone and tell us a little bit about Bard College.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. So the Center for the Study of the Drone is an interdisciplinary research and education community at Bard College. And Bard is a very small liberal arts college in upstate New York. And we do a lot of research on a lot of different fields relating to unmanned systems. We study the military applications. We also study the domestic applications of drones and the legal side. And we created the centers as sort of like a place for all these conversations to happen. And so that's what we do at the Drone Center.
Well, that certainly is a new area. I think the center was stood up in 2012.
That's right. Yep. So it was created in 2012. So when I was a student at Bard College, we created it with a group of faculty there. We've organized a couple classes there. We have lecture series there and in New York City, but a lot of our work takes place online on our website.
One of the things that you recently wrote on, and we'll use this as the jumping off point between the two conversations, is the news reported that there was an internal U.S. Air Force memo that identified that the drone fleet or the RPA fleet was at a breaking point. And I think this was probably a memo that nobody wanted to get leaked but got leaked. So I'm interested in what your observations at the center were about these comments and how it had fit into the thinking that you guys have been working on.
Right. So the memo was from General Herbert Hawk Carlisle to the Air Force Chief of Staff, General Mark Walsh, and it basically said that there was a perfect storm of both increased demand for ISR resources, and that includes unmanned systems, but at the same time, there's also decreasing personnel resources. And sort of there's not enough staffing to meet the high demand of ISR that's required for, you know, missions against ISIS and growing number of responsibilities across the globe.
And this was really focused, Dan, wasn't it, on the human talent as compared to having enough MQ-1 Predator or MQ-9 Reaper drones. It was really about having enough human talent.
Precisely, precisely. The problem is not the hardware, it's having the headware. It's having the number of personnel resources, the staff, all these unmanned systems that are coming into service. We just saw an order, you know, in the proposed 2016 budget for 29 new Reapers. So we see an increasing number of systems that are being introduced and not enough manpower to staff them.
Dan, do you have any stats as to how many drone or UAV pilots exist in the, I'm trying to change my
remotely,
yeah, change my language after the colonel's instructions. How many crews we have out there? Is that in the public domain?
It's not to my knowledge. We have an idea of how many aircraft there are in service. And that number has tripled, since 2008. I'm not sure exactly how many crews we have in service at the moment.
Yeah, the last
I can say is that
the last thing that I could find was that the Government Accountability Office reported that the Air Force had recruited 110 drone pilots against a requirement of 179. That's a pretty big delta. But that's 2013 data, so that's really kind of old data at this point.
That was the April 2014 report that was collecting data from 2013, and that's really just the latest in a slew of reports that have come out from within the military and also from without that have been examining these crews of RPA operators, and beginning in 2008 with a study from the Naval Postgraduate School that was looking at RPA crews. The data was collected from 2006. It found that there was 50% of the people that they interviewed said that they were too sleepy to perform at high performance. So there was, even in 2006, there was manpower staffing problems, and we've just seen report after report since then, 2011, 2013, and the latest report in 2014, that the manpower issue has not gone away. And so the leaked memo was not really, didn't completely come as a surprise for us in that sense.
And have you tracked at the Center for the Study of Drone what the sort of emotional toll is on those who pilot, both the pilots and the sensor operators and the intel guys who we've just learned it sort of takes a crew of three to fly that through the mission. Have you been tracking how they are impacted?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, there was a 2013 report by the Armed Services Health Surveillance Center that looked at this very issue, and I'm glad the colonel touched on it in his last couple of minutes there. And the main problem is, it's not really a problem, but the main issue at stake here is that these RPA crews live two lives every day. Mm-hmm. Right? They live their lives, their domestic lives, and they live their lives operating in a combat environment. And so that's really really focus point for a lot of these studies is examining that issue and examining the sort of unique stressors that are taking place that impact these RPA crews. So that really is focus of a lot of these different studies and of how do we solve those problems? How do we get past that?
Dale, jump in.
I just had a quick comment. I was reading your website here, and you've got a story here about how they bumped up, they've had difficulty recruiting pilots to go from real airplanes to remotely controlled airplanes. And I can certainly understand the reluctance for a pilot to give up that sensation. And,
yep.
But they've gotten a big jump in incentive pay. It looks like they're up to $1,500 a month. To get them to go, to become pilots of these aircraft. And the other thing is probably the, I can't think of the word off the top of my head right now, but the stigma almost of flying these aircraft versus regular airplanes. And it says that the upward mobility for drone pilots is limited. I mean, I guess where do you go? Is this going to be something that the Air Force or the military is going to have to figure out as a rotation in your career as you move along?
Yeah, and again, these are issues that have come out in the past year, but they've really been identified since those initial studies in the mid 2000s, that 2008 Naval postgraduate study. So these issues have been around. And the Air Force announced that they were going to increase the incentive pay last month, but there has been a lot of focus on the crews of our peers, and that's important, but we should also keep in mind that we're also talking about all the other intelligence analysts that serve in support of these RPA crews. I mean, they feel the same demands of the increased operational requirements and sort of the increased number of missions that are happening. The demand for ISR is not going down. It's not going to go down as far as we can tell. So it's the RPA crews, but it's also the intelligence analysts. It's all the people who operate in that system.
I don't think our civilian audience probably understands the amount of tension that is involved in flying a mission, even remotely. You have to be, hyper alert to everything that's going on around you to make sure that your mission is a success. And to come down from that is really difficult sometimes. And as you mentioned earlier, the idea of, okay, you fly your 4, 5, 6 hours and the airplane that you're flying is 20,000, 10,000 miles away, and then you go home and play with your kids. That's going to be a difficult transition for anybody.
Yeah, I think that, and Dan said it right, that sort of domestic life versus the warrior life, before they were separate, you went to Afghanistan, you had your warrior life, and you had a difficult transition maybe coming back to your civilian life. But now they live side by side, day by day, week by week.
I think that's going to be hard.
Yeah, it's really, it's this new technology, and there are a lot of unique stresses involved in fielding this this new technology and fielding it on such a wide scale. We've introduced unmanned systems at such an extremely high rate into the Air Force that we're still trying to catch up. The Air Force is still trying to catch up and understand, what are the operational stresses that are impacting these RPA crews, but also how do we develop a system for recruitment, but also for retention. And those are the two big issues that Hawk Carlisle identified as well or alluded to in this internal memo. But Hawk Carlisle has expressed similar feelings before, and to reporters last year, he said, we have more missions now than we have money, manpower, time. And that's a direct quote from November 2014. So it's really, I think, a real red flag that's going up right now, in the Air Force.
And they're increasing, as you mentioned earlier, they're increasing the number of these, Reapers. They want 29 more of them in the next couple of years. So that's 29 times. I don't know how many people involved.
Right,
you know?
at least the pilot, the sensor operator, and the intel guy, times three, right?
Yeah,
there.
And if you get rid of the A-10 Warthog, and who wants? Oh well, that's why we're not politicians here. We just report on it. We try to.
I was wondering, Dan, if your research had do you look at foreign research papers or other topics are other countries sort of beginning to struggle with or think about these same issues that we're talking about?
That's an interesting question. Very few countries have introduced unmanned systems on the scale that we have. I think the only comparison would be Israel. and I haven't read many studies of the psychological impact on about unmanned system operations on their pilots. I think what's unique about the United States is that these pilots are operating so far away from the actual combat zone, from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from Syria, but also that we've introduced unmanned systems into the military at such an advanced pace that we're really trying to play catch up in a sense here.
And Dale, I think you can probably comment on this. In with the sensor technology we have now is beginning to get so good, the resolution I suspect is so high that you can really, you're there.
Mm-hmm.
As a chopper pilot, you're there, but as that fighter pilot or bomber who's way up in the air, you're not really there. So there's got to be a lot of difference between seeing it and sort of being more removed from it.
I would agree with that. I think, most of the fighter pilots that we have talked to on the program have always said, they drop their bombs and they're gone. And it sounds like in this particular case, they drop their bombs and then they got to go back and recon to see what the bombs did. And they're all, so they can see the damage that they've done. And I think that also could play a psychological effect on the pilots and especially the observers.
Yeah, the sensor,
operators. Guys. Yeah.
Has that been discussed in the literature, Dan?
The comparison between manned, pilots of manned aircraft and unmanned aircraft?
Yes, yeah.
Yep, yeah, it has actually. Several of the reports have considered that issue, particularly the 2013 report by the Armed Services Health Surveillance Center. That found that there was, among the pilots and operators of drone aircraft, there was the same level of mental health problems that they experienced as the pilots of manned aircraft who were deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. So that was the first study of its kind, and I think there will be more successive studies after that. But it sort of adds to the conversation that there are, even though they're not in theater, they're still experiencing the same or similar kind of mental health challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So before we hit the top of the hour and run out of time, Dan, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Center for the Study of Drone, because your focus isn't simply on drones, RPAs, for military application. I think it's a little broader than that, isn't it?
That's right. So, yeah, we look at the domestic applications, the business world, the industry world. We do an extensive interview series with people who are working with drones, who are studying drones. We think about drones in all senses. We have an ongoing series of drone art. That's pretty interesting. So we study drones from a lot of different perspectives.
And if folks wanted to find out more about the center, how could they reach you or reach the center?
Yep, they can go to the website, dronecenter.bard.edu, or email us at csd@bard.edu.
So, Dale, since you've got it up, why don't you give that website again? He went really fast.
Okay, well, it's just the dronecenter.bard.edu.
There you go.
Yep.
And it looks like this is a great spot for all of you people that are interested in remote piloted aircraft to find out more information. I got some great articles here. There's all kinds of things. This is cool. Thank you very much.
It really is.
Thank you.
It's a changing field, and so I think you're right at the front end of that wave with some of the changes in technology. And it's easy to focus on the hardware, but we here at Veterans Radio like to tell the stories of our veterans, and that's really talking about the human wear, if you will.
I think so. I think our next goal is to get a pilot, if we can.
And I should tell you that I worked like
all
over the place trying to find an RPA pilot who'd go on the air and talk, and it was not possible at this time. So to the extent we can find somebody, we will.
Maybe he knows one.
Dan, we appreciate you coming on Veterans Radio and talking to our listeners, updating us a little bit about what's going on out in the literature. Continue your research in this topic area. I think it's going to be very exciting over the next decade. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And with that, we want to thank all our Veteran Radio listeners. Remember, you can Find us on veteransradio.net. You can like us on Facebook to stay with us. Go to our podcast at podbros.com.